So a few years ago, the folks at Disney, they decided that they wanted to better understand what the experience was like in their parks for the 2- and 3-year-old set. Like, when a 2- or 3-year-old visits Disneyland, what captures their attention? And so they hired cultural anthropologists to come in and observe, like walk through the park and observe the 2- and 3-year-olds, and then report back. So any guesses as to what they discovered most captured the attention in all of Disneyland for the 2- and 3-year-olds? Candy trash on the ground. Some of you have 2- and 3-year-olds, I can tell. All right, the characters. Those are the things I kind of, that I've been, I'm a ways from 2 and 3 now. So I thought, oh, the Disney princess. But no, none of these. What most captured the attention of 2- and 3-year-olds in the entire park were their parents' cell phones. But not because of the cell phones themselves in the usual way that we think about screens being attention-grabbing, but more because the kiddos observed how the cell phones were successfully holding the attention of their parents. Right? And what the kiddos most wanted, of course, was their parents' attention. It is a core human longing, one that we kind of learn to manage over time, of course, as we mature, but it remains a core human longing to capture the attention of those we love, to hold another's gaze, to hold their sense of concern or care. Attention is the most basic ingredient in any relationship. So that to give another our attention is a way that we tell each other that we matter, that we are worthy of this precious, limited resource. I've been thinking a lot about this word that we use in English to describe attention. We say that we pay attention. I think it's instructive, this word pay, because what we pay attention to is like other things that we pay. That is, it's a way to ascribe worth or value. Attention is a resource, a limited resource, so that when we give it to another entirely, when we pay attention to another, or when someone pays attention to us, it's a big deal. It says that we matter. It says you have value. I have value. And still, just think for a second, will you, about the last time that you can remember someone giving you their undivided, total attention for a sustained period of time? Or when did you give your whole, undivided attention to another for a period of time? Or really, when did you last give yourself whole, undivided attention? These can be uncomfortable questions today, these days where all possible distraction is just a thumb swipe away, right? And these days where it's hard to say exactly what we are even paying attention to in any given moment, because all experiences today and our attention in them seem to blur together. That is, our attention of work and home, or home to work, or local friends with friends from long ago and far away. I've had people tell me that sometimes they've listened to the sermon podcast while working out at the gym, which is awesome. But also, there was a time when your attention to the gym and your attention to church, these two things never intermingled. Right? And there's a whole host of other things that we might say that about. There was a time when these things never intermingle, and now they're all mixed up. Sometimes I get confused these days what undivided attention even means. Which brings me to poor Marshall at the barbecue. Haven't we all been Marshall at one time or another? trying so hard to pay attention to friends and family, to joy, to let joy capture our attention, and yet finding instead all the obligations and the worries of our lives instead flooding in and robbing us of that choice, that joy. And that is what it can feel like, right? Like as if our attention is being stolen in those moments. Like it's impossible for us to even choose to put our attention, this limited resource, where we really wish it could be. And actually, I think it's true sometimes that our attention is stolen from us, or at least it's true that lots of people and systems and corporations would like to steal our attention if we let them. And most of the time, we do. And what's more, most of the time, we like it. Let me give an example. Let's say right now we decided that we were going to have a little conversation over here in this corner about Harriet Tubman. Like maybe a few of us have seen the movie, right? So we're going to talk about it from that perspective. And then others could join in and they say, I've read a biography. And then others join in because they read the book Underground. And then as we start to talk, we realize that we're not sure which of the things each of us is saying is actually based in historical fact or which things actually happened. Now, if this conversation happened a few decades ago, we would just let this uncertainty stay, right? We would just write it out. We'd come back next Sunday after a few of us had gone to the library, a few more of us had seen the film. But today, instead, what would we do? Right, Google it, or like, hey Siri, right? This is a habit that our brains love. Our brains love to demolish all uncertainty right away, right? We no longer need to wait any amount of time to know. We can know now. We can turn our attention away from the person right in front of us, the moment that's right in front of us, the life that we're actually in the middle of, and instead turn our attention to finding the answer. And the more that our brains have gotten used to this as a habit, this habit of waiting, of not waiting, of learning the answer right away, the less that we are able to stay focused in the moment, in the conversation, the less we are able to learn to wait for that answer, even just a little bit. But the thing is that life and relationships, other people, are filled with moments of uncertainty. And so if we are going to truly pay attention to life and relationships and other people, our brains actually have to get used to learning to wait, even just a little bit longer. They have to get used to learning to wait to know. For those of you that are trying the tech fast, that a few moments ago you raised your hands, if you're trying that tech fast, you might be experiencing some of this. Because you're remembering in that tech fast how to wait to know something. This is true about all of our collective practices and any of our spiritual disciplines that you might try, as these practices reconnect us to our agency when it comes to paying attention. That is, they reconnect us for how to pay attention with intention. In spiritual practices, we choose to set aside time where we can practice that old idea of undivided attention. And we remind ourselves that we can do it and why it's worth it. When it's hard, and for a long time, it will be hard. We learn that we can bring our brains back to tend to those things that we choose. And over time, we do get better at it. So that when we find ourselves at that backyard barbecue, we might just be able to let ourselves and our attention be fully captured by joy. This time, this hour, literally this one that we're in right now, this is another way that we practice paying attention with intention. Starting with what I consider the central question of any of our worship gatherings, which is the question of what is worthy of our attention? I mean, do you know what is truly worthy of this precious, limited resource? It's not a question that's easily answered, really, and it changes over the course of our lives. And so we sit here and listen and tend to discover together not only what we are told is worthy by capitalism or consumerism or fake fights on social media or the old voices in our head that say who we should be or what we should do, but instead to discover and to claim what we genuinely, personally cherish. And then we practice paying attention to these things, these people, these questions, this call, so that we might make our life a discipline of attention to these things. The root of the word worship is worth, after all, to shape worth. And still, I know, I confess that there have been many times when I've come to worship, not usually when I'm leading it, but more when I'm attending it, and all of this is happening up here, I can find myself suddenly, without even realizing it, scribbling away on my order of service, a to-do list, or a grocery list, or I pull out my phone and just send that one text I forgot to send earlier, but I suddenly just now remember, I don't know, maybe it's just me. Nothing like a few moments of sitting and not doing to immediately bring to mind all the things that you have forgotten to do. It's another way that our attention ends up being stolen, by the way, because there are so many different inputs these days that we become scared that we'll forget something, forget to do something. And so as soon as we remember, we want to do it so that we won't forget. So mostly I want to say thank you for all of your self-control, because most weeks, as you're remembering those things, you don't get up and immediately start doing them. But this is part of the practice, right? That we are here together, so we help each other stay put, so that as you are breathing deeply, I remember to breathe deeply. And as I give in to this time, we give in to this time, this life, this choice, this remembering how to make this choice. If we are going to be intentional about attention, this limited resource that people will want to steal, then we need all the practices we can find, all the community, all the tools. Because attention is limited, but the possibilities for where we might give it, where we might pay it today are not. Over sabbatical, I experienced one version of this because I got a preview of what many of you who are retired have tried to explain to me. That is how after retirement, you wonder how in the world you ever had time to work. I get it now. I mean, regular daily things, they require so much attention, or they can. If you let it, like laundry, cleaning the kitchen again and again, transporting kids all over the place, cooking, taking the dog for the walk, so many things. There's just not enough attention, even for these most basic things. And it's not just the things that we might give our attention to in our lives, but there's also just all that happens that needs to be absorbed. I mean, life. Life is a lot when you're paying attention to it. In these days of school shootings, another one this week, did you pay attention? Or children separated from their families at the border. There was an article that came through on my newsfeed this week. I didn't click on it. Did you pay attention? and environmental devastation that the earth every day makes harder and harder not to pay attention to. I mean, I could keep going, but also on top of these, there's the regular part of being human, regardless of the times we live in, the part of life that is loss and grief and also supreme, boundless joy. It is difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. Naomi Shihab Nye writes. And I think of the moments of life of falling in love and babies being born and being overwhelmed with the generosity of a whole community committed to courageous love. It is difficult to know what to do with so much happiness if we really pay attention to life, to all of life. It is so much. As I kept thinking to myself as I was returning from sabbatical out of practice, as I was with hearing so many stories of life all at once in those first couple of weeks, I just kept thinking to myself, paying attention to all these feelings is not very efficient. Paying attention to life in its fullness is messy and slow, tiring. Luckily, in the midst of these underdeveloped thoughts, as I returned from sabbatical, I ran into a note from Quaker teacher Parker Palmer, who was a little more eloquent. He offers this insight on contemplation, which contemplation is another way I would describe paying attention to life in the deepest, fullest way. He says, contemplation may eventually lead to bliss. But first, it will give us the pain of knowing that some of our deepest convictions are shallow and inadequate, even wrong. Contemplation first deprives us of familiar comforts, and then it replaces them with an inter-emptiness in which new truth, often alien or even unsettling, can emerge. The contemplative journey from illusion to reality may have peace as its destination, but en route usually passes through some fearsome places. It was about mid-September when I was having these thoughts, these observations about paying attention post my sabbatical, when Gracie, my daughter, who's in eighth grade, she called me from school crying. She had just come from class where they had watched the videos from 9/11. I mean, the news videos. And then looked at the photos that I don't even have to describe to you because immediately when I say that, you know which one I'm talking about. Gracie was crying not just because of having seen and felt the loss, the terror of this event, but also because her teacher immediately moved on after showing her class these things into an analytical discussion. Gracie, however, could not move on, not after turning her attention to that terrible, tragic event that happened 4 years before she was born. She was overwhelmed, afraid, horrified. Gracie is one of many people today that struggles with attention, a reality that I share with her permission. In her case, this struggle shows up sometimes as giving too much attention when the world expects her to give less. Sometimes the other way around. And so we work with her and support her to learn how to adjust to these expectations that are not easy. But when she called me that day in September, it hit me that at least some of the time we have it backwards. At least some of the time, the amount of attention that Gracie believes something deserves is right, and the rest of us who can simply move on are wrong. Our capacity to not paying attention to those things that we know but don't fully know is wrong, whether we're talking about brokenness in the world or brokenness in our marriage. Loss of habitat and species, or the loss of someone we love, paying attention is courageous and vulnerable, and it is the only way to heal. Paying attention with intention is the only way to heal. Now, as far as I've discovered, it's only in English that we use this verb pay when we talk about attention. In Spanish, in turn, we usually say we lend attention. In French, we make attention. In Finnish, we attach attention. There's a whole host of other ones, but my favorite of all that I discovered was actually the Hebrew way of speaking about attention. Because in Hebrew, you don't talk about attention exactly, but instead you speak about setting your heart to something. In Hebrew, it's understood that attention is an orientation of the heart. As Victoria Safford has said, there have always been all kinds of ways to sever the self from the self, to sever the self from God, to sever the self from others. And yet the world today has never needed us to get more clear, more committed, more courageous in setting our hearts to that which is most worthy, which remains as ever the love which binds each to all, the love that calls us ever on. May it be so, and amen.